This episode of The Orb is brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform for creating a blog, website, portfolio, or an online store. Create your own space today by visiting squarespace.com and use offer code TREK9 to save 10%. And also by TrekFan, where you'll explore new places, learn new things, and collaborate with other fans to solve puzzles, complete real-life mission objectives, and win great prizes. Put your love for Trek into action by visiting TrekFan.org and help us move the world one step closer to the Star Trek future. Plus, if you'd like to support our programming personally, visit trek.fm/donate to get our new alien badges and art prints featuring original illustration by Tobu Ushi.
This is J.G. Hertzler, General Martok on Deep Space Nine, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome, Niners, to another episode of The Orb, our dedicated Star Trek Deep Space Nine show. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me once again, as he is every week, is my esteemed co-host, Matthew Rushing. Now, Matthew, are you ready to retake this podcast from the Dominion today?
Chris, I've never been readier. You know what they say, fortune favors the bold. Let's do this.
So, grab your sons and daughters. Let's go behind the lines. Hide in the rocks and shoals. I think it's a time to stand, Matthew, and time to retake the show.
I think it is, Chris. This is definitely the time where we don't look back, we don't worry what we've left behind, and we go and sacrifice angels if we must.
We must. It's time to just move along home, Matthew.
It really is, Chris. I'm feeling a little cueless right now. And I feel I just am. I'm feeling cueless.
Okay, I think we've jumped the vole here a little bit with our title usage. We're not going to be talking about those episodes today, but we actually are going to be talking about that lead up. Many of the episodes that we mentioned there, the lead up to Sacrifice of Angels, and we're going to specifically be talking about the conclusion of that storyline that started season 6 of Deep Space Nine. The retaking of the station from the Dominion, and we're going to do a commentary for Sacrifice of Angels. Now, Matthew, this is one of my favorite Deep Space Nine episodes.
Chris, it is mine as well. This was a fantastic open to season 6, having this big, long 6-part arc and ending with the Sacrifice of Angels. I think, honestly, just blew everything else out of the water. You know, showing you that Deep Space Nine was really going to be something completely different than you'd ever seen before, even from itself. I mean, just really making you work for it. You had seen them lose the station and you thought, oh, okay, well, it'll be fine. They'll get back. It'll be fine the next season. But no, they drug this out. They made you wait. They made you watch. They made it realistic. And ending with this episode, fan-stinking-tastic.
Absolutely. Well, let's jump on into it, and then we'll talk more as we go along. So everyone, if you want to queue up your DVD, queue up Netflix, however it is that you watch your Deep Space Nine, get that ready, and when you have it ready, come back here and get set to hit play. In 3, 2, 1... play.
Last time on Star Trek Deep Space Nine. This was smart, I thought, Chris, that they did add, this whole, last time on Star Trek Deep Space Nine, because if you had missed a couple of the episodes maybe or something like that, I mean, this is before DVRs and maybe you hadn't got a chance to tape it or something, it may have messed up. Giving you this recap was really important because there's a lot that had happened.
Most definitely. And they're able to catch you up quickly, though, so they don't spend the entire you know, right. first 10 minutes or more telling you what happened.
Well, even in this recap, you know, I was watching it the other day, just kind of getting ready and just thinking through some of the things. And I just every time you get to the Odo parts, I'm so mad at Odo. You know, I still am. Every time I watch these episodes, these six episodes, Odo just drives me crazy. And so...
He does. He does. You know, that bit there with Sisko, last week we talked about great Sisko episodes. And this is a great moment for Sisko as well, where he really takes charge and retakes the station and is really a great leader for Starfleet at this point.
Yes. In fact, what I thought was so interesting about this episode, too, is you'll see here as they get up to the line and they realize they're really outnumbered. And watching Sisko come up with a plan to at least try to draw the Cardassians off, you know, you can tell that Sisko can think, you know, three-dimensionally. He can think in these large scales, which, you know, not every captain can do that.
Right.
But Sisko has this ability to see the large picture and how it's all going to work together and then, you know, take those chances when they can. And I thought that was one of those, this is one of those moments where you see he is a little bit set apart. What he's been putting to the test here is a little bit different than a Kirk or a Picard.
It's also why this is a great chess match. This whole war is a great chess match between Sisko and Wayun.
Which Wayun are we on at this point? Wayun 5? Wayun 6?
Oh, yeah.
I think we might be on Wayun 5.
Maybe.
So, because I think... Because then you have the wayward Wayun, you know, who defects. And... So, I can't, and they all start to run together after a while. Huh. One way Yoon, yeah. It's all the same. I always loved this, that they're quoting this old poem, and, you know, only O'Brien and Bashir would know this together. You know, you can just tell it's part of one of their holodeck programs. It sounds like it's, you know, and that's the Road of the 600. I don't even know what battle that would be, but it definitely sounds like something that they play in the holodeck because they love those no-win scenarios.
Well, they do love the historic battles, so although I'm sure they would prefer to not be actually out here fighting in a real war.
Right.
This does play in very well to their personalities and their interests and what they do together on the holosuite.
Right. Well, in that shot that we just saw of the fighters swooping in, you know, you see that Starfleet has little fighters, Star Wars type fighters. Yeah. And then that shot, you know, in this whole beginning of this episode, I cannot wait for HD for this because just some great stuff. I mean, really beautiful shots. And it's going to be tough for them to do, honestly, with all this CGI. And if what we saw before, we'd seen from the Trek Collective, the upgraded, come on, Chris.
Oh, you saw it at Trek Corps. They had the
Nebula
USS
class,
Honshu,
yes.
The re-render.
Exactly.
Yeah, that was,
which was amazing. Really nice. Yes. And so I think that'll definitely be amazing when we do see that on screen. So,
you know, the battle scene right here reminds me something that Ira Stephen Bear said about this whole series of episodes that they did here, is that you do have to be careful when you're writing something like this because it's very easy to fall into that trap of what he called the hero's story, where you have these epic space battles. And that's something that, you know, Star Wars does. And it's actually something that Star Trek Into Darkness did as well, where they kind of fell into that trap of these big action sequences and battles. Here they do a good job of balancing that and doing what Iris said they wanted to do, which is that they really wanted to keep the story focused on the human aspect of the pain of war. And so even though there's this epic war going on, all these battles are going on, they do a good job of staying focused on the characters themselves throughout all of this.
I think you're right, especially in this episode, because you could have gotten really carried away with that. Mm-hmm. It is really funny. I was watching the TNG season 4 extras, and they have the talk with the art department. The art department actually spends more time talking about Deep Space Nine than they do The Next Generation.
Do they? Yeah.
It's very funny because they start talking about the station. They start talking about all the work they did on Deep Space Nine and everything. I think they're actually more proud of their work here than they are on The Next Generation in a lot of ways.
Well, I think it's more creatively challenging.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
Those people, they want to continuously be challenged and to improve their art form. Mm-hmm. And Deep Space Nine gave them more of an opportunity to do that.
Yeah.
Than The Next Generation did, because yeah. once it was set on The Next Generation, it was pretty much set for the series, and you had fewer opportunities to create new things.
Exactly. And whereas here, even looking at the station, the intricacy of everything that goes into just something like ops is pretty yeah. fantastic. And so what I love about this scene is when they're here is the, oh gosh, the self-righteousness and the smugness of Dukat. He can feel victory, you know, he can taste it, and he's so sure of it. It's so interesting, and what's funny is that by playing into Sisko's trap here, he actually loses the battle right here. He doesn't know it, but he'll lose it, because giving him that opening, Sisko takes it, he makes the most of it. The Klingons show up, of course. I mean, and Dukat's overconfidence is what, you know, is his undoing. If he had just waited, you know, 5 more minutes, the minefield would have been down, all those ships would have come through, and all hell would have broken loose in the Alpha Quadrant.
I like Damar here, because Damar, even at this point in the series, seems like someone who is better equipped to see both sides of a situation than Dukat is.
I think, yeah. Well, and not only that, but he's not overtaken with this idea of power. You know, he's still, I think this is the thing, the seed that you see in Damar. He's still very much a Cardassian. You know, he hates the Dominion. He hates that they're allied with them. He's only using them. You know, Dukat is so enamored with his power. In fact, we'll see that later in the scene he has with Weyoun. He's so enamored with this megalomaniac type power that he's got now, he quickly loses focus from right. everything. And Damar doesn't do that. He's very focused on trying to win this war so then they can get rid of the Dominion. And Dukat's like, whatever. We'll get rid of him when we get rid of him, you know. But, you know, I'm going to bring Sisko to his knees first, the Federation to its knees first.
So much of Dukat's goal is getting Sisko more than anything, and that's always right. going to be a downfall for you if you're so focused on a personal agenda mm-hmm. in that way compared to what's better for your country or your organization or whatever, mm-hmm. your company, whatever it is. You lose focus on what really matters.
Well, in this conversation right here, is Damar can see that Zial, even though she's Golden Cot's daughter, is not his daughter, a true Cardassian daughter,
mm-hmm.
and which bothers Damar, obviously, right now. But Dukat can't see that. He's too busy with the fantasies in his head of who he is, how his daughter feels about him, all of those things to be able to see it. And so I think that's really interesting to watch the interplay between these two, because it'll mean a lot as the series goes on.
Now, this is really cool here, because it shows the depth of the characters on Deep Space Nine, that you've got a situation where Quark, of all people, Leeta, Jake, and Kira are plotting to stop the Dominion. Three of these four people, you would never imagine being involved in this if you went back, you know, especially a few seasons back in the yeah. series.
Well, and this is where I think we might differ a little bit, Chris. And this is why I enjoyed having Jake get left behind or stay behind on purpose, because it actually gave his character something to do, and it really created mm-hmm. some growth in the character that, you know, he was going to fight this war and do this war in his own way, you know, whereas his father, obviously, a soldier at this point, that's not what Jake wants. But at this point, Jake is now just like Kira, you know, as a Bajoran back in the day. Mm-hmm. He's a resistance fighter. And just like so many people like Jake, who were just everyday people, say World War II, turning into resistance fighters when they never would have done that in the first place if they weren't.
Right.
You know, they didn't have to. So good character growth for Jake, even though he's neither of our favorite character.
Right. But remember, the problems that I have with Jake on the show aren't things like this. It's actually right. that they should have done more things like this with him throughout the series so that you could come to know the character and actually feel some connection to the character a bit more. So right. It's good that they're doing it here. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Again, too, a very smart plan with Damar, I think. He knows what's going on in the station, again, even more than Dukat, and mm-hmm. makes sure that he can take care of the people who would get in the way of sabotaging the station, making anything go awry. Just really shrewd, which again will play in and later on in the series, where he's willing to do things outside of the box, or at least, you know, think throughout the entire situation, not just his own, you know, glory. It's not really about that for him. That's another key scene.
Now, another great space battle. I love the Jem'Hadar ships, by the way, with the purple nacelles.
Yeah.
They look so awesome in space.
I do love this whole scene.
There's your line, Matthew. You missed it. Bashir said, "It's a trap!
It's a trap!" I love this scene, though, because it just watching everybody on the bridge do their thing, you know?
Yeah.
The interplay between them, you can tell in a lot of ways on this bridge, in this scene, you know, rank has kind of gone out the window. Everybody's being able to talk to Sisko and give him their opinion without necessarily, you know, they've just been through a lot. So it's a great scene. And then this is just fantastic.
Yeah, this is amazing.
Oh, the comms are down. Yep.
Jamming of course the they're down.
Yeah, they've got a rotating EM pulse. So, which if it was a rotating EM pulse, wouldn't it knock out every single electrical system on every ship in that battle right now?
You'd think so, but you know, then the episode wouldn't be very interesting. So
yeah, it was a really short episode. That was how it should have ended. for this
all
episode.
The ships just lose power and yeah. float in space.
It's a big floating like space graveyard. Yeah, to me, this was always a really key scene for Dukat, just showing you kind of how crazy he is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when he talks about the whole idea of the real beating of an enemy is bringing them to their knees and making them basically tell you how great you are compared to them. That's, I think, the exact definition of megalomaniac. If you look it up in the dictionary, it's just Dukat's picture.
Well, that's the thing, you know. People argue that Dukat is not, that this is not how he is, but it is. If you watch the stories, that is who Dukat is.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think,
especially at this point in the series.
Yeah. I really do think that this is a very, you know, we can talk a little bit about Dukat here. I think this is a very natural progression for him. Because he's shown the signs of this if you watch the series and you get to this right. conversation and you realize this is really how this guy thinks. And then, of course, you get to an episode like Duet, where you finally kind of break through the veneer that he puts on and he gives you the real him, the super insane one. You know, the one
Are you talking about Waltz?
Waltz, excuse me. Yes, not Duet. Yeah. Waltz. I apologize, fans.
Yeah, I get those two confused as well, just because the title implies the same. Yeah,
exactly. Which Duet would have been a good name for that episode, Waltz,
it would,
actually.
Yeah. That's so, why I often confuse it as well.
But yeah, this is a really, really key scene that Wei Yun's face too is just priceless. Like, oh.
He's like, you're crazy.
It's exactly what he's thinking. Oh, you are crazy. Goodness. All right. So this is what we're really dealing with.
Yeah.
Oh, I had no idea. Oh, goodness. And the fact that the Bajoran people still refuse to appreciate how lucky they were to have me as their liberator.
Exactly.
How are you? Yeah, exactly. I mean, the fact that he sees himself as a liberator for the Bajorans when he's clearly a dictator, you know, a maniacal maniac. So. Wei Yun,
gosh, there are no statues. Yeah. Where are all the statues?
Oh, I love it. Wei Yun, I guess not. Oh, good stuff. Very funny. So, well, and this too, I think, is the scene that will set up Waltz, which is he wants nothing more than Sisko to say, I'm better than you. Or you're better than me. Like, you know, you, Dukat, are better. You're smarter. You're everything I'm not. I wish I was you. That's basically what he wants to hear from Sisko.
Better looking.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, you have better head ridges, neck ridges. you look better in any kind of uniform or out of uniform. So. This is the part, that really bothered me about this whole run, Chris, was just how gullible Oda was. I understand his desire for his people and everything, but he just seems so un-Odo-like.
Does he? The thing, I mean, I get it to some extent, but the thing about Odo that I've always felt is that Odo will go along with the status quo. Whatever happens to be the status quo in the station at the time, whoever happens to be in power, Odo will just fall in line and serve them. And I say that because we saw what he did when the Cardassians ran the station. Mm-hmm. And then we see what he does with Starfleet. And he butts heads with Starfleet a bit. He still wants to do things his own way. But he wants to do things his own way in support of what Starfleet needs.
Right.
And so in this situation, he just kind of fell in line with the female changeling. And so I don't think it's completely out of character for Odo to get sucked in by this. But it does really bother you, right? Because you feel like he should have more loyalty to his friends at this point, not to be sucked in by this.
Yeah.
And it's only now that he's starting to snap out of it a bit.
Well, and it's, you know, I don't know if you'd call it cliche, but it's, you know, love saves him, his love for Kira. Which, you know, it's one of those things that I think is really cool, the power of love to change people. And to bring them out of something. It, you know, for Odo, the love of his people isn't strong enough to sacrifice the love of the relationships that he's created on the station, the people that have been with him for so long now.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's really cool. So, and then another
great
scene.
It takes him a while to get there.
Yes, it does. It really does. Yeah, this is going to be so good in HD. Just...
You know, when you talk about, people ask you, say for your football team, if you had to choose a quarterback of all these great quarterbacks, who would you choose for your team? When it comes to starships, I'm taking the Defiant. I want the Defiant to be leading my fleet down the battlefield.
Exactly. A blade of armor, you know, quantum torpedoes, pulse cannon phasers. I mean, just...
And just the maneuverability of that ship.
Exactly. Because it's a little bit larger than their fighters, but it has the maneuverability of one more so than, say, like, Oh, well, let's turn on a dime with a galaxy-class starship.
You're not going to do that.
I love, too, and I mean, of all the pilots in Starfleet, I think the one I'd want the most is Dax. You know, I love Tom Paris, great pilot, but Dax, any day. What she can do with the Defiant's pretty much magic.
Mm-hmm. Although, what could Tom do if he were flying the Defiant as opposed to Voyager?
That's true. I mean, he does have the Delta Flyer. He's very handy with that. So, it'd be interesting. That's an interesting thing. That's a good poll question. Better pilot, Jadzia Dax or Tom Paris?
Ah, okay. That should ruffle some feathers. Let's put that on the site.
Yeah, we should do that. I love this too. Again, Dukat in his overconfidence. Should we have anybody go after him? No.
Yeah,
fine.
Just let him go.
Yeah,
it's
just
all right.
I mean, we'll destroy him when he gets here. So, I have to say, to me, I really liked Zial as a character, and so what happens to her here, and especially I didn't really have a problem with any of the women who portrayed her, but when they got to her finally. I felt like the character really blossomed and could have been something a little more, even more interesting. And then having her sacrifice, obviously, in the episode was tough for me to watch because I was really enjoying her character. And, you know, obviously you were invested with her and Garak too. So,
well, she's a great character, even though she's not on the show for all that long, not so many episodes. But when they first brought her on, of course, you think, okay, this is kind of strange. Dukat has a daughter who's going to come on the station. The fact that she's half Bajoran, I mean, that makes perfect sense, of course, that Dukat would have fathered children with Bajoran women. But the way they use her on the show is great because she means so much to Garak. She means so much to Dukat. And she comes to mean a lot to Kira as well. I mean, she really influences Kira's views of the world very much.
Yes. I love this because Quark is playing it so perfectly for this Cardassian. And I love when he's like, lift the lid. I love that line. The way the guy delivers it, lift the lid. It's just really, really funny. He reminds me of like he should be a linebacker on a Cardassian football team.
Stop poking it. It's very delicate. Now you've ruined it.
Oh, gosh. Very cheesy James Bond type lines right there for Quark.
Right.
We didn't mention it earlier, but when Damar is like, y'all have nothing to hide. And then he looks at Leeta and goes, you sure don't.
You sure
don't. Yeah. Oh, man. I wasn't sure if he was talking to Leeta or Chase Masterson at that point.
Yeah, I don't know. Was that Casey Biggs talking to Chase Masterson?
Yeah, exactly. That was just a line he had thrown out in there about Chase.
I improvised that one.
Oh, this is so funny. You don't move. Okay, nobody moves. Okay, wait. You just told nobody to move. Okay, fine. You stay. You open the cells. Ugh, Quark is great in the scene.
It's actually good that they wrote it this way because it can come off as being really silly. But if you think about it, this isn't the kind of stuff that Quark does. And so for him to kind of bungle it like this as he does, it does make sense.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you're facing down two Jem'Hadar. I mean, I'm surprised Quark can aim that well and actually hit them in the first place. So
he can't snap out of it.
Yeah. He's completely shocked at what he's just done.
Uh-huh. Oh, and goodness. So is Zial. You know, you would think that on Starfleet vessels and facilities that they would put some kind of armor over these control panels by now. How many years have people been blasting these panels and deactivating force fields?
That's true. That's very true. I wonder, though, I mean, do you have to have a code to deactivate the panels at that point? I mean, it's not like anybody else can reach them.
I think it's just 000, deactivate, 0. That's
probably
the standard Starfleet code.
Yeah. it does sound very familiar. I feel like it worked on the Enterprise. It should probably work on Deep Space Nine. They didn't really change the access code. It's like Spaceballs. What's the air shield? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. That's the dumbest code I've ever heard. It sounds like somebody's luggage. What idiot put this together? Remind me to change my luggage when we get back.
So here we go. Here goes the female changeling.
And the change in Odo.
Yeah.
This reminds me of the scene in the original Star Wars movie when Han and Chewie are running around and they run into the, you know, it's very Star Wars-like.
Yeah.
I love, too, that it's Rom running around with a, you know, big old Jem'Hadar phaser and, you know, Kira. And it's just such an unlikely pair.
It's one of the great things about this show is that these characters, they don't stay the same throughout the 7 years of the show. I mean, even a character like Rom, who could come off as just an idiot, basically, really turns into a good character.
Yeah, definitely. I love this scene too, because it does say so much about Odo and Kira and so many and so little words, you know, when he says, "I think you know," it just it's another kind of Star Wars line, you know, when Princess Leia says, "I love you," and Han says, "I know," and Odo there goes, "I think you know." So,
well, and here they're jumping into the trash chute. So, yeah.
Exactly. Exactly.
They've got it all going here.
Exactly. Man, this is a Star Wars episode. So,
it really is. I hadn't really thought about it that way very much in the past. But as we're talking about it here, sequence.
Yeah,
after
and the
sequence.
One lone ship who's going to go in and destroy, you know, like the Death Star, the Hurt Ball.
The Hurt Ball. That's a reference to literary treks this past week, right?
Yes. For all those who missed it.
You know, it's interesting here that they talked about, they talked to some of the actors about doing this 6-episode arc, and Nana Visitor said that for her, it's really hard for her to remember where the different parts of the story fall. You know, which episode does this part of the story fall into? Because for the actors, this was all just one big episode, all six of these together.
Yeah, I mean, it really is one great big continuous story, and it's one of the neat things is, I mean, you can sit down, and if you have, you know, a little less than 6 hours, you can watch this entire run and feel like you've seen a really epic movie.
Mm-hmm.
And with many faceted parts, I mean, it's just a really well-constructed arc. Probably, I honestly think probably the best that Star Trek has ever done when it comes to massive arcs. Everything just plays together very, very well here. And it's the one I probably have rewatched all together the most.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and here comes the big moment. And Dukat is still very smug here. He's so confident.
Well, and I mean, at this point, you know, you think, oh, holy crap, you know, we've lost, you know, what's going to happen, you know, how, there's no way, what could Sisko possibly do at this point?
Do you feel like if this were the Next Generation, the minefield would not have been detonated? Like, Rom would have flipped the switch just in time, and the minefield would not have been detonated?
Yes, I do feel like that would have been the situation. And what they create here, though, I think is something much more mythic and epic. And obviously what Deep Space Nine was going for. And of course, it plays into the whole story we've talked about. You know, starting with Emissary, this is another big step in the confrontation that Sisko will have with the prophets here in the wormhole. You know, challenging them, if you want to be gods, then be gods. Mm-hmm. And so the conversation is just really interesting because, you know, they have that whole thing about, you know, we don't care about corporeal beings and linear time and all this, and yet they really do. I wonder, and I meant to, I guess that's a question I want to ask you. Why do they say that? Because that seems to be so not true. So
that
are
they don't
trying
to care about corporeal beings?
Yeah. Are they trying to see, do you think they're trying to play Sisko at this point? Or just see where his heart is, or?
I don't know. I've kind of always taken it as these prophets are explorers in a sense. Like they, without getting into the whole history of how they became involved in the Bajorans in the first place and why they protect the Bajorans, after the events of Emissary, where they really, really question Sisko about linear time, I feel moving forward and here, like, they are exploring, they are trying at this point to figure out what is unique about corporeal beings and what is unique about linear time. And Sisko is the way that they explore that is through him.
Yeah, that part I can see. I just, it seemed to me, maybe that this was really this the first time that they had had contact with corporeal beings in, you know, millennia beyond millennia. And so it's almost as if they've either forgotten or they just never have had. They've always been this way. They haven't evolved. They've always been like this. So this is really the first time. But see, then again, they've traveled outside of time on purpose to create Sisko, so they know what corporeal beings and time and all of these things are.
True. Yeah.
So that part of the story kind of falls apart a little bit.
It does.
I guess to me, it always, this part, when I think about the whole of what I know with the prophets, with this scene, I feel like they are trying to see where Sisko's heart is. Is his heart really with the Bajoran people? Is his heart with really, you know, doing what it's going to take to save Bajor the same way that they would want to? They're still testing their own emissary is what I feel like.
Yeah, I agree.
Because then at least the storyline makes more sense, I guess, with how they've interacted before with linear time and corporeal beings. And
this is also a bridge where, like last week, we talked about Rapture quite a bit. And we talked about how Sisko is very resistant to the idea of being the emissary initially. As the series goes on, more and more things happen to him. He becomes more interested. He comes to be unable to deny that his life is intertwined with these prophets. But he tells them, here, you have no right to interfere with my life. At this point, he's still fighting against that reality of his life. Whereas by the time we get to the end of the series, he really has embraced his role as the emissary of the prophets.
Well, and of course, at this point, he doesn't know about his parentage. And so, you know, I think by the end of the series, in some ways, he feels some kind of kinship with them because he really is part prophet.
Mm-hmm.
And what I think is interesting, you know, that they talk about he tries to control the game. It's like it almost seems like the prophets have set some things in motion, you know, like as a god might. And they are talking to their emissary now, is somebody who's trying to control what they've put in motion. And I think that's a really interesting idea that in some way, the way that, you know, say a Moses was able to, quote unquote, change God's mind. He was going to destroy Israel, and Moses petitioned that the Lord would not do that, and the Lord doesn't. The same way, Sisko's doing that, literally, with the prophets here standing before them, saying, no, you can't do that. You can't let your people die. You've given them orbs. You've made them create an entire religion around you. You're responsible for them. So it's very, very much a Moses-like experience that Sisko has at that moment.
Yeah, we talked about early on this show, maybe third episode was, I believe, when we did Sisko. And that's what we talked about a lot, was the fact that he is like a Moses figure. And this really supports that position very much.
Mm-hmm. So, Chris, is this a cop-out here with the prophets, everything? I think we talked a little about this before, but it's a good discussion real quick.
This is like the great deus ex machina of Deep Space Nine. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I can certainly understand how some people may feel that way. And I think it's a valid argument. But I don't feel that way myself, just because it was established from the very first episode of the series that these prophets play an important role in events concerning Bajorans, and then later the Alpha Quadrant, and also that Sisko is part of them.
Right.
And even though this is a magical solution to a major problem, and it is, in a way, a reset button, it works within the context of Deep Space Nine because it's not completely out of the blue. It's been set up, and it's something that you can accept is a power that these prophets have. And it's also not a reset button because there are consequences to this. You know, Sisko will no longer find peace on Bajor. He's been set down another path, and we do see how that plays out as the series goes on. So there are severe consequences here.
I completely agree with you in the sense that, Chris, if they had not set up the prophets the way they did in Emissary, this would be a complete cop-out. This would be very bad writing. But because they've spent so much time building this into the story from the very beginning, to then go ahead and use this out that they have makes complete sense. And like you said, it doesn't not play out later. And, you know, if this had been another Star Trek series, well, it starts with a V, this would never have been seen again. But, you know, Deep Space Nine will make sure that what it's done now in this very pivotal episode will have repercussions later on.
Right.
And it'll take a while to see those repercussions, but you're definitely going to see them.
Well, and that's good that it takes a while. You don't want it to turn around and have repercussions in the very next episode, necessarily.
Right. Right.
But the key to it all is that if you have set something up in advance, especially far in the past, and then it has consequences, then in my eyes, it's no longer a deus ex machina that just comes out of the blue and therefore ruins the story.
Right. Which Star Trek has definitely been very, you know, it's had that problem before.
Well, they do quite often, kind of,
You know, with their technobabble, just kind of pulling something out of the magic bag of hindsight, the magic bag of technobabble.
And DS9 is not immune to that, but
yes, it's true.
More often than not, they find a way to make it work in a realistic way. Okay, now here is one of, this scene always gets me when I watch this episode.
This is, I was thinking about this, I think that this is the only scene that I really see with Dukat where I feel like that he truly loves Z'all.
Yeah.
This is the scene where I feel like he's realized that he does really love her, and it's not just something else, because when she tells him that, you know, she's betrayed him, he says, you know, do you know what you've done? And then he still wants her to come with him, whereas the old Dukat, I think the one who wasn't in this position wouldn't be like this. But I feel like he's realized he's losing everything. And the only thing I feel like he can't completely live without at this point is her. So Yeah, it's a
and
it's
here
a rough
she
scene.
Confesses to him that she yeah. helped.
Well, and see, normal Dukat, I would have thought, you know, he'll backhand her and yeah. be like, get away from me. But, you know, his reaction to her here is so much different. The fact that he's going to run to her and comfort her and love her. So.
Now, this scene here was truly shocking to me when it happened. When this episode yes, first yes. aired, I couldn't believe that this had happened. And of course, I thought in advance of watching the episode, as well as the episode was going on, that the title, Sacrifice of Angels, referred to mm-hmm. the prophets and that the wormhole was going to be destroyed.
Right.
And then when you find out that it refers to Zial, I thought it was really brilliant and it was shocking to me.
Well, and truly, you know, the innocent character in all of this, you know, the one that has nothing to do with any of this. You know, she's been brought into the world, obviously, in a way that nobody would ever want to be. She's been treated so horribly. She's finally found a home. She's finally found a family. And she is the most innocent of characters on the show. And then for her to be the one that dies, it is a shocking, painful thing to see. So, you know, effective drama, if not just heartbreaking, though, to watch.
And then all the reunions here.
Yes. O'Brien and the chief immediately going to warm up the Alamo or the Battle of Britain or, you yeah. know, whichever one they've decided. And I think this was the hardest was...
And this is difficult.
Garrick,
where Garrick
yeah, it's just, comes in. Well, in the way that he reacts to it, you know, and he says, mm-hmm. You know, I could never understand why. It's such a painful thing because the love that Zial has given to Garrick is unconditional. And Garrick is one of those people who definitely believes he does not deserve unconditional love from anyone. And of course right. he can't understand that. He's never experienced that in his entire life until her. And I can't imagine the emotional toil it would take on him to have that ripped away. And then of course later on to work with Damar, the man who killed her. Mm-hmm. Is
oh, definitely.
Huge. I mean, both him and Kira. So, you know, this...
The death of Zial here was also a great setup for that situation
yes.
where
yes.
Damar and Garrick have to work together.
Yes.
And then here, this is also very powerful, seeing Dukat just broken down like this.
Yes. Very, very cool to watch, you know, him... You know, and again, too, this is where I think that me saying that he's a megalomaniac plays in, because a megalomaniac can be broken.
Mm-hmm.
And what comes back is somebody who's even more megalomaniacal when, yeah. you know, he's quote unquote healed. But, you know, to have all that's happened to him, yeah, this is going to be the result.
The scene here of him handing the baseball to Sisko is one of my favorite scenes in Deep Space
yes.
Nine.
It's a very good scene. All in all, I mean, hands down, one of the best episodes of Deep Space Nine, I think, ever. Chris, I think we were talking about the other day on iMessage, you were just saying that you felt like you had, I think you'd even written something for Trek FM, you know, listing your favorite episodes.
Yeah,
and this might have been in your top five, you said.
I wrote that a long time before I ever started Trek FM. I actually wrote that about...
Okay.
It's like 12 years ago now, probably 13 years ago when I wrote that. But I had ranked, you know, my favorite episodes.
Right.
And that was even before I was as into the character side of Star Trek as I am now, because I was a lot younger then. But even at that point, I listed Sacrifice of Angels in my top five best Deep Space Nine episodes. And... Of course, now it's even higher on my list because I'm much more interested in the character
right.
interactions
exactly.
than I was at that point in my life. So Yeah, definitely. Well, what are your final thoughts here on Sacrifice of Angels?
Chris, you know, I don't know what more we could say about just what a fantastic episode it is. Obviously, it is an episode that works best after having seen the five previous episodes.
Oh, definitely.
Knowing
you
everything that goes into
it. Lead in.
Yeah. Right. So it's not an episode that definitely stands on its own. So it can't be one of the greatest episodes ever of Star Trek because it does need a backstory. But yeah, on a whole, this being the end of a huge arc, you know, a lot of times the end of an arc is a letdown. But for me,
yeah,
this is hands down probably the, you know, if not the best episode in the arc, one of the best episodes in the arc. And it's hard to say that one is really better than the other because all of them are good. But this is just quality work, the visual effects work, the character work, the story work, everything here is really pitch perfect.
Yeah, it's a good point. Yeah, often these things do kind of fade out at the end. On Warp 5 this week, we talked about the Augment arc from Enterprise, and we talked about how the third part of that, the Augments, is actually the weakest part of the story. And you often feel that way. And I'm big on middle parts in general. You know, like I like The Search for Spock as the middle part of that TOS film trilogy. I like The Empire Strikes Back as the middle part of the original Star Wars trilogy. I like middle parts of stories because I do feel that they tend to be stronger than the resolutions. That's where so much of the meat is. But in this case, they beautifully built this story up.
Yes.
To Sacrifice of Angels, and they made it all pay off at the end.
Yes, they do.
Yeah. So it's, I hope everyone enjoyed our little journey through the episode today and some of the points that we touched on. It's hard to touch on everything you want to talk about because you're following the action that's happening on the screen, but it was a lot of fun nevertheless for me, Matthew. But you know, it's not the only thing that we've been talking about on Trek FM this week, so here are some other things you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, The Orb.
Great Sisko episodes.
I was definitely channeling Sisko, but it's a great episode to watch that passion come out of him, that he is a passionate captain, you know, and man.
The Ready Room.
The Devil in the Dark.
Wouldn't there be a point if they can go through rocks so easily that they would have depleted that entire planet of its resources in the last 50,000 years?
Decade.
Voyager STO.
Well, Voyager's pretty much the only series that hasn't had much content.
Yeah, think about it. You've got loads from the original series, loads from the Next Generation, and you've got pretty much all of the main ones from Deep Space Nine, apart from the Vorta.
To the journey!
Kes.
Kind of like the reverse of a kangaroo. It's like this pouch on her back.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That would be kind of unusual. It would be the most unusual maternity uniform ever.
Commentary, Trek Stars.
What dreams may come.
It's kind of like 1984. And just like in 1984, like, that guided tour is more interesting than most books that have an extremely compelling story.
Warp 5.
The Augments arc.
You know, and as you say, all of this was about, from his perspective, trying to improve humanity and thinking he was doing the right thing, and he was not prepared to do absolutely anything for it. He wasn't prepared to kill another human being.
Trek News and Views.
A Taste of Armageddon.
So basically, some scientist goes to Commander and said, look, I've developed this new weapon. No, you can't do that. It's not in the rules.
Literary Treks.
Mission's End.
The question is, do you feel like Section 31 is overused? Everyone wants to use Section 31, and so they just keep popping up in every story, and I think sometimes it does a disservice to the idea of Section 31.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out all of these shows and get your daily Trek Talk fix. We have new Star Trek Talk for you every day of the week, and some days we even have two shows for you, and you'll find them on iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, Windows Phone, Xbox Zune. You can download from the website. You can stream from the website. Many, many ways for you to get our shows. And you can go over to trek.fm/pd for podcast directory to get all the links. So Matthew, let's tell everyone where to contact us if they'd like to share their thoughts on Sacrifice of Angels. You can go to our website at trek.fm/contact. There's a form there. choose to send to a show and choose the orb, and that will come to Matthew and me by email. You can also leave us a voicemail by clicking on the tab that you'll see on the right side of any page on the website. When you click that, a box will appear. You can use your webcam's microphone to record a message and then upload it to us as an MP3 file right there from the box. You can also talk to other listeners and the rest of the Trek FM crew by going to our forums at trek.fm/forums, and you'll find us on Facebook at facebook.com/trekfm and on Twitter under username TrekFM. And Matthew, what if people would like to chat with you about DS9, Sacrifice of Angels, or anything else?
If you'd like to do that, you can find me on Twitter at MattRushing02. And then, of course, Chris, we do Literary Treks, where we talk books and comics. We frequently talk about Deep Space Nine on there as we're working our way through the Deep Space Nine relaunch. And you can also find me on my own blog at 42lifebetween.wordpress.com. Now, Chris, when you're not sacrificing angels, where can we find you?
Yeah, I don't like to sacrifice angels, to be honest. Although sometimes I do, just for fun, I try to disarm minefields because it's really challenging. I like that
yes,
challenge.
Yes, it is. It is, especially if they've been designed by Worm. So
that's right. Yeah, you can find me on Twitter. My username is C. Brian Jones. That's the letter C and Brian with a Y. And you can find me pretty much everywhere in social media under that same username. And like you, Matthew, I have my own website. That's at cbrianjones.com. And then elsewhere on the network, besides Literary Trek, you'll find me on Tuesdays on The Ready Room, sometimes with Matthew, sometimes with other hosts from all around the Trek FM network. And we talk about Star Trek news and all 5 live-action series there, as well as some special topics from time to time. And then on Fridays, you'll find me with Kate Walsh on Warp 5, where we talk about Enterprise, very much in the way that we talk about DS9 here on The Orb. So check me out on those shows as well. And, you know, if you enjoy The Orb and you have time to head over to iTunes and leave us a star rating and a written review, we'd really appreciate that. We'd love to hear from you. And it does help other Deep Space Nine fans find the show when they search iTunes for DS9 podcasts. So drop by there. It only takes like 30 seconds and let us know what you think about. Also, Matthew, before we go, we'd like to ask everyone to please support our sponsors for this week's show. First, there's Squarespace, the web's best hosting and CMS that makes it simple for you to create a beautiful blog, website, portfolio, online store, or anything else you can imagine. Create your own space today. I know you're going to love it. Go to squarespace.com for your free 14-day trial, and then use offer code TREK9 to save 10% off your lifetime purchase on new accounts, and choose the annual plan, and you'll get a free custom domain registration as well. So check them out. Support Squarespace. That helps us bring The Orb to you every week. And we really thank Squarespace for their support of Trek FM. Also, please visit trekfan.org. Now, this is a great chance for you to come together with other fans to use your love of Star Trek to move us towards that Star Trek future by solving puzzles and completing real-life mission objectives. And along the way, you'll win great prizes as well. So go check it out. It's a great challenge for you, perfect thing for Star Trek fans. Support us, support Trek Fan by visiting trekfan.org. And we thank them for their support of The Orb as well. And lastly, if you would personally like to support what we're doing here at Trek FM, we have a way for you to do that. If you go to trek.fm/donate, you'll find 8 alien-themed badges and art prints there as a thank you for your contributions. They're beautiful original illustrations by Toba Ushi, who does most of the artwork that you see on our website. And you can mix and match badges and art prints. You know, choose which ones you want as badges, choose which ones you want as prints. The prints are A6 size. They're very beautiful. There are different contribution levels that you can choose from as well. And your donations help us cover the costs of production, storage, and bandwidth that's needed to bring The Orb to you every week. So please visit trek.fm/donate and give us your support. We really appreciate you doing that.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, and we'll see you next time as we gaze into The Orb.